right.
Hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case. Good morning or good afternoon and aloha everyone. On behalf of the court, we're excited to be here holding oral argument today in the Ronald T. Waimun Judiciary Complex in Kapolei, and we'd like to extend our appreciation to Judge Browning and the family court for their assistance in arranging for our appearance here today. Counselor, are you all ready to proceed with your arguments today?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
My understanding, Mr. Pasquale, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so a green light will come on when that 10-minute period is hit. Mr. O'Brien and Ms. Toller, there will be a five-minute warning for each of you when that point part of your argument is read. Also, the court would like to remind the parties to refrain from mentioning the parties in this proceeding by name. We ask that you refer to them by their role in the proceeding. Does everyone understand that admonition?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Pasquale,
thank you, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, I am Patrick Pasquale, Deputy Attorney General, representing the Department of Human Services, DHS. There are four issues before this court that was presented in our petition. I will be concentrating on the first three issues. Contrary to the popular belief of the vast majority of the persons in the gallery, the first issue is the most important issue to DHS, that the ICA erred in ruling that DHS does not have the discretion to place children in its custody, specifically permanent custody, thereby overruling this court's ruling in Doe 100 Hawaii 335, which stated, upon the termination of parental rights, discretion to determine an appropriate custodian is vested in DHS. After termination of parental rights, custody is given to DHS, which is charged with finding a suitable home for the child, citing to then HRS section 587-73B2, which is now codified in 587A-33B2. The ICA also erred in applying the rules of statutory interpretation in making its narrow ruling that 587A-15D2 does not give DHS discretion. The ICA should have interpreted the statute in context of the entire CPA, the Child Protective Act, I'll be using the acronym CPA, and other related provisions regarding DHS, such as the enabling statute in Chapter 346 and Chapter 350. And the ICA failed to interpret that statute in pari materia. DHS's exercise of its discretion is subject to review by the family court in a CPA proceeding. We are not asking the court for unbridled or unfettered discretion. However, we are asking the court to give DHS its due discretion as a state agency designated by the legislature to fulfill the state's duty to protect the children of the state of Hawaii and to place them when they are removed by the state from their families. The ICA's erroneous ruling that DHS does not have discretion to place children in its custody is the second part of the second issue. What is the correct standard of proof? That erroneous ruling that DHS does not have discretion to place was a shaky foundation that the proper standard of the family court's review of DHS's exercise of its placement discretion is the pure best interest of the child standard. It should be the abuse of discretion standard, which is the DHS abuse of discretion when it determined that the placement is in the child's best interest, whether DHS disregarded the rules or principles of law or practice, that it's a substantial detriment of a party, specifically the child's best interest, and the decision exceeded the bounds of reason.
Mr. Pasquale, the part of the ICA opinion that you're speaking about that appears to indicate that DHS has no discretion to place the child, is it your interpretation that the ICA was literally saying it has no discretion to place the child, or was that a comment upon the standard of review or the level of deference that might be appropriate when the family court reviews that decision.
Your Honor, we interpreted the ICA's decision and said DHS does not have discretion to place, because if you look at its analysis in of 587A-15D2, it went through a lengthy analysis stating that DHS has the rights and duties or obligations under Section 15, but does not have the discretion to place.
What would that mean if they don't have the discretion to place? It's literally the child is going to be placed nowhere? Is that how you interpret what the ICA was saying? Or is that, again, that would come back to the question, was the ICA literally saying no discretion to place, or was it commenting on the appropriate level of deference?
It was basically our interpretation is we have no discretion to place, Your Honor.
So not only no discretion, you mean no authority? In other words, you have to go to the family court judge for the initial placement?
Is right.
Does the ICA ever say that?
No, it didn't, Your Honor, but that's what the absurdity in the interpretation is, that you have the duty and the authority, but no discretion.
But isn't the Chief Justice's interpretation a more likely rational interpretation? One would think if that was the interpretation that the ICA was advocating, that they would have said something like, you have to go to the family court judge for initial placement. There's nothing like that in its decision.
No, but that is the practical effect of the decision, Your Honor. Because to get to its ruling that the standard for the family court's review of the just exercise of its placement discretion, it had to get to the point where to say that we had no discretion to place based on this court's ruling in Doe 100 Hawaii 335.
Aren't discretion and authority two different concepts? I mean, the ICA never said you didn't have the authority to do the initial placement.
Well, we do have authority, but do we have the discretion to place? We still need to get permission from the family court prior to placements, Your Honor, as we stated in our petition.
Didn't the ICA state that the family court has the ultimate control over placement? So doesn't that assume that you would have the, as 587A15D2 says, the duty and right to determine? How can you say you have the duty and the right to determine, but you don't have the discretion?
Well, basically, Your Honor, in a normal CPA proceedings, placement can occur even before the filing of a petition under voluntary placements. Is what the ICA saying that since we have no discretion to place, even on a voluntary situation, where the family agrees to place a child in foster care without the filing of a petition, we don't have the discretion to place. Who has the discretion to place? If you take that literal ruling. But once
So are you basically requesting a clarification?
Yes, Your Honor.
Of the ICA decision?
Right.
Even if we do not agree that the ICA said what you believe it says?
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, do we have the word discretion? What does it mean? Do we have the discretion to place? And how do you reconcile the ICA's ruling with the ruling of this court in 100 Hawaii 335, where the court said we do have the discretion to place? And that doesn't also go with permanent custody. Under 15B, under foster custody B1, it also has the same language when the department has foster custody of a child. The rights and duties to place a child subject to the family court's order if the child's going to be placed outside of the state of Hawaii.
Mr. Pasquale, the ICA said, in effect, that the determination of where the child is ultimately placed was an independent decision that the family court had to make without having to determine whether or not the DHS had abused its discretion. Is there a conflict in that reasoning?
There is, Your Honor, because the ultimate, in that part of the decision, which in 7 Hawaii App 547, which the ICA overruled, the ICA, as a practical matter, was correct in stating that the first determination of which placement is in the child's best interest is made by DHS. It's expert opinion that this placement is in the child's best interest, which the ICA characterized in that case, which is overturned as an ultimate finding of fact. So initial determination is always done by DHS subject to the family court's review when there is an open court case, Your Honor.
And could discretion reside in DHS to place the child, but the question of whether or not that placement is the appropriate one be subject simply to a determination by the court without respect to whether or not there had to be proof of an abuse of discretion by DHS.
Such as whether the court's independent, if it's based on the court's independent determination that this placement is in the child's best interest. That
yes,
is correct,
because
Your Honor.
Isn't the CERC, the family court, obligated to make findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And do you folks make findings of facts and conclusions of law at the initial placement?
It's based on our report, Your Honor. Whenever the DHS files a petition, DHS is obligated or required by law to submit a report, which is called a Safe Family Home, based on the Safe Family Home Guidelines under 587A11, I believe it is, which outlines, among other things, information about the child. And there's specific information regarding placement in the report. And in that report, it does state where the child is placed, why this placement is being made, and certain circumstances as required by federal law, why we're excluding relatives as required by law, Your Honor.
You know, you're arguing that there should be abusive discretion standard. But my question is, at the permanency hearing, isn't one of the determination that the court makes whether the current placement continues to be appropriate? That's the... So circumstances could have changed since the initial placement. Why would a court need to have to find an abuse of discretion if circumstances have changed? I mean, is this like a three-tier standard you're advocating? It's abuse of discretion, but there's if there's change of circumstances, and it's hard to follow.
Rhonda, part of the one of the things, the unique facets of a Chapter 587A Child Protective Act case is the record is continuing from the filing of the petition or even beforehand until the end. So there is a change of circumstance, and change of circumstances do change in terms that require change of placement. For example, a child may have been in a certain placement, be it relative or non-relative, but something happens in the resource caregiver's home which the child was harmed, which requires removal of the child to another resource home. So the family court is obligated to determine whether that placement is safe and appropriate, or as it says in 31C2, in the child's best interest.
Doesn't that reflect the legislature's intention that it be the family court's own review without deference to the administrative determination of the agency, that the family court is obligated to make its own review of the best interest of the child without deferring to the determination of DHS, although of course listening to it, looking, giving it persuasive value, but not giving it administrative deference.
As I stated earlier, the legislature gave DHS the duties to fulfill the state's duties to protect the children of the state of Hawaii. We're going with that is the duty to place, and it includes licensing. So there should be some administrative deference to DHS, Your Honor, because DHS has the expertise as designated by the legislature, so there should be some deference to DHS's expertise in this matter, Your Honor.
There's one point in your ICA brief where you indicated that the family court's review of this discretionary placement decision must be based on the evidence that DHS considered in making its decision, not the family court's independent determination of what the family court believes to be in the child's best interest. Was that an argument that the family court is somehow limited to the administrative record that was before DHS and can't take into consideration other evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, that was our position at that time, and as I stated...
Still your position. Does that remain your position today?
No, it does not, Your Honor. We've incorporated that the court does have an independent basis. Even under the clearly erroneous standard, if it makes an independent review, as what happened in this case, where although the trial judge had this two-part burden-shifting test, but its ultimate finding was that notwithstanding the substantial evidence to support DHS's expert assessment that placement with a maternal aunt would be in the child's best interest, it was left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made. So, Your Honor, we're not disputing that the family court does have the independent basis, can have the independent basis to make the determination of which is in the child's best interest.
Mr. Pasquale, you're arguing that that the agency should be given some deference. And the way the statute reads and the way the judge would apply this is whether the current placement continues to be appropriate. Isn't that deference? In other words, they start off with the proposition that the child is there, and therefore the court makes a determination whether it's continued to be appropriate. That sounds like, to me, there's deference built in.
You may be correct, Your Honor.
What adverse impact would there be on the department if the abuse of discretion standard were eliminated or not applied?
Basically, it would the impact would be with the whole system, Your Honor. It would basically leave it up to a pure best interest of the child standard, which is what the ICA ruled. And the problem with the pure best interest of the child standard is there is no definite standard of what is in the child's best interest. This court has placed limitations on the family court's ability to enter findings or rulings in the best interest of the child, as seen in 96 Doe and 96 Hawaii regarding ordering an agency to pay, or 105 Hawaii, Doe 105 Hawaii, where this court ruled that the family court did not have authority to order the Department of Education to retain a child despite the DOE's assessment that the child should be promoted in the best interest of the child. And this own court.
But in this situation, how would that impact resource care placement? I mean, it's different from DOE and DOH's circumstance. How would best interest of the child adversely affect your DHS's ability to do a resource placement?
We would still have to make our determination of which placement is in the child's best interest.
Don't you do that now?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. But we'd still ask that, and that's part of our exercise of our discretion, that we make the determination that we should be given deference to what is in the child's best interest, that which includes the best interest, defining the best interest as part of the relative placement preference.
Is it DHS's position that the relative or kinship placement preference applies post-petition? You are continuing to advocate that, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's a matter of statutory interpretation. The provisions in 587A requiring DHS to make reasonable efforts to locate relatives within the first 30 days after a child is placed is based on federal law, specifically 42 U.S.C. 671-829, Your Honor, excuse me.
That isn't applicable in this case, right?
Right, Your Honor. But the argument is also made that it should be the relative placement should be restricted to the first 30 days. I believe, if I have Justice McKenna's question correct. But if you read both statutes, the federal legislation or federal statutes and 587A in pari materia, specifically the purposes clause where in 587.A-2, which states specifically that the legislature recognizes that relatives can provide an appropriate home for children in foster care. And that is also the provisions in 42 U.S.C. 671-19. And there's no time limits on those provisions. So if you read it in pari materia, there is no provisions restricting the relative placement preference to the first 30 days after
Mr.
child.
Mr. Pasquale, under the ICA's model, who would have the burden of proof?
Your Honor, that's sort of confusing. And we do need this court's guidance on...
Well, I don't know if it's confusing, but does the ICA ever say that, well, it says you have no, it says the abuse of discretion standard does not apply. And if it does not, then what standard does apply? Who has the burden of going forward with proving that a particular placement would be the appropriate one?
It should be the party challenging DHS's assessment that the proposed placement or DHS's determination on that the placement is in the child's best interest. That
I guess I want it to be clearer. If
it should be on the party challenging DHS, Your Honor.
Under the ICA model, then, which party would have the burden of proof?
The way I read it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't it didn't appear
so
that.
So under the ICA model, no party has the burden of proof.
Right, Your Honor.
So does the independent decision of the court go that far, that everyone comes before the court on equal grounds? No one, we're not really sure who goes forward. We're not really sure who has the burden of proof.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that was the problem with the trial court in due respect to the trial judge. We had to reconcile the three cases, the ICA's opinion in 7 Hawaii Ave 547.
Has the legislature indicated at least some preference for some limitations on what DHS can do and the courts can do?
In terms of what, Your Honor?
In terms of where the child should be placed.
The only references is the relative placement preferences and the placement being the child's best interest.
Do they actually say relative?
Yes, Your Honor. They use the term relative, I believe.
They say parents and they say family. Do they ever say relatives?
Mr. Pasquale, you did indicate that 587A2 says that the 2008 amendment, the legislature recognizes that many relatives are willing and able to provide a nurturing and safe placement for children. But that sentence follows the sentence that says the legislature finds that prompt identification, et cetera, and disposition of cases involving children that have been harmed are in society's best interests or in the children's best interests. And when you look at the statutory scheme, the relative placement or the family placement, identifying relatives early on, is all pre-petition. Are you suggesting that the legislature intended that post-termination and when a child has been with and has bonded with a resource family for several years, the relative placement trumps the best interests of the child?
I will answer your question this way. It is a preference, not contrary to a popular belief. It is not a mandate to place with relatives. Each case must be, and each child must be looked at on an individual case-by-case, child-by-child basis. And
well, in this case, Mr. Pascua, the court expressly found that both the relative and the foster parents were willing and able to provide a home for the child. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there was substantial evidence for putting the child in either home.
Yes, sir.
And there's no question that the child had visited with the relative and I may be incorrect, but bonded with the relative and with the relative's daughter.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So in essence here, everything is simply left up to the judge to determine what best interest of the child is?
Right, Your Honor, and that's why we're asking for that due deference. In this case, these are two excellent families, and the deciding factor with DHS was the relative placement preference. And we were fortunate that this child was able to bond with the auntie with a prolonged court-ordered transition plan. And so, in other words, with that due deference to DHS, it should go with placement with auntie. However, the trial court saw otherwise. And going back to Justice McKenna's question, if you look in 587A-B regarding relative foster placement preference, Part A says Subsection A states that DHS shall provide the child's relative an application to be the child's resource family within 15 days of the relative's request to provide foster placement for the child, and it goes through the steps. It doesn't restrict it to the first 30 days after the child has been placed. The reason why we want to place the child within the first 30 days is to minimize the number of placements. However, this case illustrates the systemic problem when the only safe and appropriate relative placement is on another island or in another state. When DHS intervenes to protect the child, DHS is invading the liberty and privacy interests of the child's parents to raise their child. So the parents must be given a reasonable opportunity to reunify.
And DHS identity. If the parents of the child and the foster parents are both equally capable of providing a safe family home, but the foster parents have the financial ability to do much better in terms of the child's education, where does the best interest of the child lay?
We should not. I'll answer it this way. Although in 95 Hawaii, this court overruled the ICA's opinion, and I'm sorry, I don't have the side, but in that opinion, the ICA had a statement that when you're looking at comparing families, it's not in the child's best interest that one home has child cert on its library, the other home has binging to the max, one has all the amenities of life, or the other doesn't, comparing one rich section of the island as opposed to the others. So, Your Honor, we have to look at the total interest of the child. There are adoption assistance that are available if they do qualify. And I see that the green light is on, Your Honor, so I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Actually, though, in terms of this, the facts of this case, the family court actually received a lot of substantial evidence that the bonding was not equivalent, that the child was attached to the foster family, that the child considered the resource parents as her parents, the siblings as her siblings. And it was a totally different situation with the maternal aunt, correct? It's not just safety. We're also talking about attachment, correct?
Thank you, Your Honor. And if you look at the article that I cited to in my application, Your Honor, regarding that was on the amicus brief that was submitted in the adopted couple v. Baby Girl case, even the attachment issues theories is subject to doubt or attack. But the issue before the court, too, is can the child reattach? We had the consultant, Dr. Jennifer Takahashi, that stated that this child would do good with either family, provided that the transition is appropriate if it's going to maternal aunt, and also the child maintains the contact with the other family.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pasquale. And I know we have, before Mr. O'Brien begins his argument, I know we have a number of people standing in the back. We have four seats up here. If anyone wants to come up and sit down, please feel free to do so, because I know there might even be folks who can't hear out there who are out in the hallway, and we apologize for that. So, we got upgraded to jury box class, I guess. So, Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Francis O'Brien, and I represent the foster parents in this matter. It is our position that the Court should affirm the decision of the trial court and also affirm the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals in this matter.
Do you think we need to clarify the ICA's language with respect to DHS's discretion?
The only thing that I would say, Your Honor, the answer is no, but. The answer with regard to best interest of the child is really something that will draw a bright line and will make it clear what the focus of the hearing is when you deal with the question of where a child is going to go. One of the questions that was asked was the question of deference. The only thing that I would say is that if you make the party challenging the department's position, if they have the burden of proof, then you have given the department's position deference, because then you have to prove that something the contrary is what's best for the child. But our judges in these cases every day, in all different kinds of hearings, make decisions for these children that are based upon the standard of best interest.
Are you suggesting that we should apply some sort of presumption to DHS's initial discretionary placement?
I don't think it would. It's hard to say that it's a presumption, because any presumption, my understanding, Your Honor, is that once you introduce evidence to the contrary, presumptions disappear anyway. I think that the question is, if you believe that the department's position is entitled to some deference because of their position or because of all the resources that they have, the best way to deal with that, that is fair to everybody, is to say the standard is best interest, but if you don't agree with the department, you have the burden of proof that your position is correct. That way, the department still comes in with all the resources of the state of Hawaii. They have all the resources that the state can bring to bear in support of their position. You have the burden to show that somehow what they're saying is not in the child's best interest.
The ICA wasn't explicit on that point. Would you agree?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Although the trial court was. The trial court made it very clear that we, as the people who were challenging the department's position, did have the burden of proof. So that I think that that was the way the case was tried, and I think that the evidence very strongly supports the decision of the trial court. Now, when I was going to get up here, one of the things I was prepared to address was what I thought was one of the core questions, and that is whether or not the trial judge should have the ability to make an independent assessment of the question of best interest. And as you had noted in their brief, the department had said that the judge should not have that discretion. I think that it is important and it is central, because a great many things flow from that, if the judge has the ability to assess what is in the child's best interest, because that comprises all the evidence that would be before the court, all the reports that are submitted, as well as any testimony that is submitted during the trial. I also feel that that is not really inconsistent with the other decisions that have been rendered, because from our perspective, you get there no matter which way you go, because as I argued in our brief, it doesn't make any sense to me that you should have a situation where the trial judge would believe that something the department was doing was not in a child's best interest and yet be unable to do anything to prevent it. The essence of what we are doing, these children are among the most disadvantaged citizens of the state of Hawaii, and what we owe them under the statute is the best possible choice that we can give them for a future that will give them the best chance to be what the statute requests, which is constructive and productive adults. So that it seems to me that if you start with the idea that the court has the discretion to do that, that answers a great many questions. Also, the court talked about discretion. If you will, the court does have the discretion to make decisions about placement. But I would submit that that's discretion with a small d, and what the department is trying to talk about in its appeal is discretion with a big D, which requires this capital D, which requires this abuse of discretion standard. It is interesting to me, if you go back to 1989 Doe, the Judge Justice Burns decision, nowhere in that decision did he actually refer to the abuse of discretion standard. All that he said was, all that the court said, was that the standard on review of the department's decision would be for clear error. In fact, it was posed to him at the beginning, and he posed the question himself as to what the department's decision was, and what he said was, you know, the question in the decision says, when the DHS is the family court-appointed foster custodian of a minor child, is the department's decision that serves the best interest of the child to remove the child from a Hawaii foster caretakers and place the child with other Hawaii foster caretakers a matter of law, a finding of fact, or exercise of discretion? And he answered, and he says, we conclude that it is an ultimate finding of fact. So in fact, that decision, the answer that he gave, did not say that it was an abuse of discretion. He posed the question and said it's a finding of fact. We believe that
he did say it was subject to the qualification that there was a priority in favor of the child's parents and family.
And at that time, indeed, there was. And obviously, Your Honor, there is a constitutional issue with regard to the parental rights, and that is a very significant one.
So are you agreeing then that the whoever that the, I guess, DHS would be proposing at the placement hearing a place for placement, but that whoever did not agree with that would have the burden of proof to overcome that recommendation.
Yes, Your Honor, with the standard being best interest.
And the burden of proof would be what? What would the
preponderance. And again, that is what the trial judge set in the case. He said we had to prove abuse of discretion, but again, I feel that you end up in the same place, because if you're looking at best interest and you make an independent evaluation of that, I have a hard time understanding something that is not in a child's best interest wouldn't be an abuse of discretion. And so that's where we are on that.
Mr. O'Brien, you don't feel that it's an ultimate finding of fact?
No, Your Honor, it's a position. I think that is a very confusing term to use. And I find it confusing because in getting ready, I reread not only Judge Byrne's decision, but I also looked at the two cases that he cited that were the basis for his conclusion about ultimate finding of fact, one from Maine and one from North Dakota. And neither of those cases stand for that proposition. They didn't involve reports that were prepared by agencies, and it wasn't. They were talking about the standard of review when the family court made findings of fact.
So you feel that our review should be abuse of discretion, not clearly erroneous?
I think your review of what happens at the trial court would be the clearly erroneous standard, which deals with findings of fact. Also, you review. The family court's decisions, the language is very clear. If the family court did something, abused its discretion, acted in a way that was either not in conformance with the law or detrimental to the rights of a party, that's one of the parts of your review on appeal. And that's very clearly set out in the law, and I'm not trying to change that, and I don't think the intermediate court wanted to do that either. But I do think
our review is not for abuse of the family court's discretion. Family court's decision, is it? Our review is for whether or not there's substantial evidence to support the family court's decision.
If you're reviewing for clear error, the standard is either that there's no substantial evidence or that the court is left with a firm and definite opinion that a mistake has been made.
You're going back to clearly erroneous. I'm saying that our standard of review is whether or not the court decision is supported by substantial evidence. And in the process of whether or not there's substantial evidence, we look at findings of fact and the conclusions of law.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So we would not be reviewing the family court's decision for abuse of discretion.
I think that it would depend what the party asserted, but I think you would review the family court's decision for abuse of discretion, and as you described, within that would be reviewing the findings for clearly erroneous and conclusions either for right, wrong, or clearly erroneous if it's a mixed question.
You know, the mixed question of law and fact, in our court at least, is reduced to the clearly erroneous standard.
Right.
You know, does that make sense to you?
Yes. Because best interest is an entirely fact.
But a mixed question of law and fact involves also conclusions of law.
Yes.
So that we would, in effect, be deferring to the trial court by applying a clearly erroneous standard on questions of law.
As I read the cases that have been decided in that area, the cases seem to say, Your Honor, that where you're dealing with questions of best interest, that is a mixed question of fact and law, and that is decided based on clearly erroneous. So it's my understanding that that's already the law.
I agree with you. That's what our law says. I'm just asking you whether or not that's the best way to go.
I think as long as we start with the proposition that the trial court is looking at best interest, yes, Your Honor, I think it is. I think that also, if the court agrees that the judge has the ability to make these decisions, the next thing that follows is this question about preferences. And with regard to that, we believe that preferences are something that is to be considered. It's one element of best interest, but it's not as the department seems to argue, something that is to be mechanically applied and to be done without regard to what the effect would be on the child or what the ultimate balance would be in terms of what is best for the child. The ICA really didn't get into the question of how much of a preference or what sort of a preference. The only place to respond to one of the questions that was asked in the statute where it actually refers to preference is in 587A9 and 8, where it talks about emergency placement, where the department simply takes a child into custody without a petition. And it says there that the preference is for placement with an approved relative.
And one assumes, since it's only found in that statute and not in the permanent placement, that that's the only place where the legislature was indicating that it wanted that preference to be applied?
That's the way we would see it, Your Honor.
Well, this court made it clear in 2003 Doe that in 1998 the legislature removed the family preferences.
And
although in 2008 that provision 587A2 was added back in.
Certainly it would be unfair to family to say that that isn't something that you should look at, but no one's ever really been able to explain to me what the legal effect of a preference is. What the trial court said was if everything else is equal, then you go with the preference, and that's about the best definition I've heard. In other words, if everything else is equal, but in this case, everything wasn't equal. I think as the court is aware, the bonding was stronger with foster parents. There were a great many ties. The child had lived with foster parents for almost 3 years at that point, 5 years now. And those are all factors which are also to be considered so that you don't simply say, well, there's a relative out there somewhere who passed a test or an ICPC, and therefore we're going to place the child with that person without regard to what might be best for the child. Again, if we're going to be child-centered, if we are going to deal with things that basically center on what is best for the child, how can the standard be anything other than best interest as far as we see it? The final point that we would make is that with regard to the department's request.
But even if we all agree that best interest of the child is the standard, people can disagree about what is in the best interest of the child.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
The legislature, at least, and the legislature has indicated that I guess the department has to follow federal law in this area, seems to indicate that at least one parameter, one limitation, one qualification on the family court and on DHS is that there is some preference for a relative. Now, I mean, you can pose the hard issue of someone who's not very involved with the child, et cetera, but is not necessarily the case here, where the relationship blood-wise is still close. So isn't this preference expressed by the legislature and expressed by the federal government in that it requires the state to consider placement with relatives? Isn't that a standard that should be considered in determining the best interest of the child?
It is absolutely a factor that should be considered, Your Honor. It is not the determinant. You would look at other things such as attachment, you would look at bonding, you would look at all the various issues, and you would make a decision balancing all of those things. The only other thing I would say is that the federal statute says consider, and the statute that was enacted, 587A, only talks about preferences in those two instances that I discussed. I see my time is up.
Any wrap-up, Mr. O'Brien, or have you said everything you needed to say?
The only thing I was going to say is that the only thing I had left to say, Your Honor, was that the idea that the department should be able to sort of resign if it doesn't get what it wants is, in my perception anyway, punishing the child for something that isn't the child's fault, because there are consequences if the department were permitted to stop being the foster custodian. It seems to me that we all do these things and we all have cases where we win or we lose, but we all go forward after that. And also, if you make it best interest instead of abuse of discretion, then the department no longer has the argument that you said we abused our discretion, and so the issue sort of disappears.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Towler.
Chief Justice and Associate Justices, good afternoon. I represent the Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem Program, which represents the best interests of the child. In the beginning of this case, the Department of Human Services did everything right in terms of trying to find appropriate kin for this child. There was an Ohana conference within a month after her birth. They did family finding to confirm that father, in fact, had no relatives. When the child needed a new placement after the Calabash placement failed, they contacted the maternal aunt on Maui and asked if she could take her. The answer was no, not now. And then they held another Ohana conference in June. It was only after that that they went to the foster family and said, would you adopt her? And they said yes. And in some ways, we think that changes the groundwork. Our request today is that this course affirm the ICA decision and overrule that part of 1989 Doe that has anyone with a different opinion as to a child's placement held to the clear error standard, which is a very high standard and difficult to meet. In the 2005, the policy announcements of the Department of Human Services changed the framework and said that kinship above all else is what must be the determination for a child's placement as long as it can pass basic muster. 1989 Doe has no basis in the Child Protective Act, the part I'm asking the court to overrule. There's no statutory basis for that clear error standard. That part of 1989 Doe has never been relied on by any appellate court in the last 24 years. We do ask for a level playing field for all the multiple participants to a placement dispute at the family court level. We are glad today that the department agrees that the family court has jurisdiction and authority over its placement determination.
When you say a level playing field, what do you mean?
So that
so far as burden of proof. What do you mean insofar as burden of proof and how the court should make its determination?
So what we're saying is that the burden of proof should be best interest of the child.
Ms. Teller, keep your voice up a little.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Do you need some water?
Thank you. That the burden of proof should be best interest of the child. And we believe that whoever asks the court to change the child's placement should be the one who carries that burden. The matter of who goes forward is just a matter of who calls the first witness. That's up to the trial court, and somebody needs to be able to do that. We don't think that that was unfair at the trial level. (clears throat) 1989 Doe starts off saying, affirming, the family court's sole consideration must be what's in the child's best interest. That runs throughout almost all of our CPA cases on this issue. At about the same time that 1989 Doe was decided, the ICA created something called Uniform Starting Points, USPs, in property division cases. This court said that is not supported by statute and overruled the USPs. The reasoning of that court then, we think, applies now, that it narrows the discretion of the family court judges and are repugnant to the statute, and it's unrealistic because each case is factually and circumstantially unique. And as this court knows, I'm sure, each child is unique and requires and deserves the good thoughts of the family court judge as to what is in his or her best interest regarding placement. There's no one better suited for that job. The family court judge is dispassionate, objective, can gather all of the information and evidence presented by the parties, and that is supported in several instances throughout the Child Protective Act.
Would there typically be a lot more information after one of these hearings than at the time that DHS makes its initial placement?
Yes.
For example, there's a lot of visits by the VJAL to the homes and speaking to the various people involved.
Yes, the church, the school, and visits there as well, mm-hmm. and with the family members. In looking at deference to DHS, we would ask this court to consider possibly not finding that it's appropriate for DHS placement decisions to have deference. Yes, they have some expertise. So does the Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem program, who employs social workers to supervise our volunteers. The department has duties and rights. Yes, they do.
Your argument seems a bit inconsistent, because you've just a minute ago said that it should be the burden on the party who's trying to change the initial placement. So aren't you giving deference if you put the burden on the party who's trying to change the initial placement?
Well, sir, I'm sorry if I was confusing. In this case, the party who wanted to change AS's placement was the department. Anyone who wants to change a placement of a child who's been in a good and stable home for a couple of years, we say that's the person who should have the burden of proof. The department has stated here an argument they've made many times before that a child can reattach.
I'm sorry, so your position is the department should have had the burden of proof because the placement was with the foster family?
In the future case, yes. In this case, we were bound, our family court judge was bound by 1989 Doe, and he did what he had to do under that case. But if the standard remains the ICA standard and best interest of the child, then we think it would be appropriate for whoever's asking to move a child in a good and stable placement to be the one who has the burden of proof.
So as opposed to the view that the burden should be on anyone who challenges or questions what DHS's judgment is, in your view, the burden should be on anyone who seeks to change the existing custodial arrangement or the existing arrangement?
If it's a good placement, yes.
Well, what if, are you suggesting then that DHS would have no discretion to effectuate some sort of change even in an emergency situation coming to court?
Sorry, not at all. They must have that, because a child's situation will change sometimes overnight, and children in at risk need to be rescued and taken care of. And the department is the entity to do that. They have the resources. They have the authority.
Isn't that kind of circular? You know, the burden of proof is on the party to show that the placement is not an adequate one, but if it's an adequate placement, the burden of proof is on that party. It strikes me as an odd position, because it presupposes the court going in having some sense of whether the placement is a good one or not. I mean, you would recognize that there's some limit, that presumably a placement has to be somewhat established, some time has to have passed before it would be the burden would shift to the person who's going to change it?
Yes.
How much time would that be?
Well, that's going to differ with every case. For us, the California statute is a good example. They say 6 months. If a child is with a certain placement with 6 months, non-kin, and then a kinship placement is found, that the foster parent should have deference. Children can't wait, and they bond and they attach regardless of what custody fights are going on around them. The attachment theory that was referenced by Mr. Pasquale is referenced briefly in our memorandum of law filed in April 2010. There is something in the record regarding that, and there is something in the record regarding the kinship placement research, which quite frankly is at best inconclusive.
What's your answer to Mr. Pasquale's point that the department is in a difficult spot if the foster place, or the place, when it's trying to accommodate the rights or allow a parent to reestablish contact with the child and in effect assert their parental rights, that may limit the court's options of where a foster placement might be to well beyond 6 months?
I agree with him. That's a difficulty. The way that our statute is set up, it recognizes the right of the parent first and foremost to the care and custody of his or her own child. It's in the termination of parental rights statute only after it's been proved that the parent cannot provide for that child, that the child's best interest comes into play in terms of the proof required at the TPR trial. So yes, it is a limiting factor. When the department went into the court that day to set that resulted in the order saying child shall have more visits with dad, that was their position too. They wanted to give the child an opportunity and the dad an opportunity to try to make it work. And so the child had to stay here. That's geography. There's nothing we can do about that. There's nothing they can do about that. The parents' rights to try to reunify with their child come first under 587A.
But almost by definition, if there's an off-island relative, that relative is not going to have the opportunity to be with the child or step up as a foster parent then.
Well, they can, and in this case, the department did bring her over every month to have as much contact as she could. She's got relatives here, and those contacts could occur. So it's difficult. It's a problem for all of us. But first and foremost, I think the parent has the right to try to reunify. Regarding the reattachment argument, the attachment research shows that every move for a child is a trauma. Every move for a child includes loss. We cannot look into the future to see how that loss will affect the child through the child's future, if she will be able to form intimate relationships as she grows up into a teenager and into an adult. That is why an attachment research, it's so important to preserve the primary attachment of the child. That's the one the child begins at birth and goes through the first 4 or 5 years, learning to trust that his or her needs will be met. When that attachment is broken, that child will suffer significant psychological harm in the future. And we think that that's an important factor the family court does and has to take into consideration. I believe my green light is on.
You have a little more. I think you have a few more minutes.
Okay, thank you very much. In terms of kinship placement, we suggest that the November 2003 Doe case already answered that question. That was a challenge by a mother against the department, and the answer was no, the family court has the discretion. We did want to make a quick comment about the definition of family, the way family is defined in 587A and in 587 throughout time, with one exception which was taken out of the statute in 1992. Family means the legal and physical custodian of the child. It does not mean every kin. So there was no preference starting from 1983 on just by the use of that language in the statute. Finally, all children in foster care have a constitutionally protected right to be free of arbitrary state decisions that have a significant impact on their custody and welfare. Such children already removed from their own homes and placed with certified relatives or strangers need a sense of stability and trust in the soundness and security of their foster care placements. Having already suffered the trauma of losing their families, such children are constitutionally entitled to protection from arbitrary state action that could indiscriminately force them to lose yet another family relationship, citing Moore versus City of East Cleveland. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Pasquale, your rebuttal.
Just to answer the point, in 587A-4, under the definition of relatives, it states that relative means a person related to a child by blood or adoption or a Hanai relative, as defined in this chapter, who is determined by the court or the department is willing and able to safely provide support to the child and the child's family. In the revisions regarding the relative placement preference, I believe that 587A uses the term relatives, which is more encompassing than a narrow definition of family. The family really pertains to the nuclear family, while relatives means the extended ohana.
Mr. Pasquale, I just want to clarify here. In terms of the relief that you are requesting here, the maternal aunt did not appeal.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so you are just basically requesting analysis of the law, correct? You are not requesting that the placement be set aside and the case remanded for redetermination, correct?
That was our request with the ICA. And our vast majority of our request here on CERT is the clarification of the law. However, this court may, and depending on how this court rules, especially with the standard, a retrial may be demanded on this, Your Honor.
But the maternal aunt did not appeal.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So should we
do you know that? What her current situation is? She did not appeal the decision. She is not here asking for the child.
That is correct, Your Honor. She did not appeal.
So are you saying that you can assert her rights?
Your Honor, we're asserting our rights as the child's permanent custodian to place, which we argue is within our authority or discretion that is given to us by statute to determine the child's. So even though
you also asked for your role to be completely terminated, you've got two arguments.
Right. And Your Honor, that was based on this court's ruling in Doe 101 Hawaii 220, where we made the argument that if the family court says rules that we abuse our discretion, that we must be terminated as the foster custodian, and went on to state that what the GAL's position was. And
is that in the best interest of the child to cut the child off from all financial assistance or other kinds of things that your agency provides?
Your Honor, that issue is not even before this court. It's not ripe for determination. It was not brought up until the application for cert in the opposition. So that issue has not come up before the family court.
Well, what would be the effect of us terminating DHS? Because you don't, if it seems that you're suggesting if the court doesn't agree with your placement decision, then you get to wash your hands. What kind of position is that?
Your Honor, that is a position. That's why we're asking this court to clarify its statement in 101 Hawaii 220. It said we agree with DHS, we disagree with the GAL, and I admit the family court. This court now gone further on to address that issue, but said it left that open ended. That was the sole basis of our argument on that issue. So, if this court can clarify that position, we'll thank you for it. And one of the things I wanted to address.
No, this might be kind of unfair, but so. You don't want to retract that fourth claim of error?
We would like to retry the case, Your Honor.
Retract.
Retract.
Retract that fourth claim of error.
Not at this time, Your Honor, because we have to clarify what that statement.
That's. Are you challenging the final order of the court,
yes,
which would award placement with foster parents?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Yes,
have you ever been excused? I mean, has your position ever been sustained in any other case where you said, oh, you're going against our recommendation, we want out? Has any court allowed you to do that?
In the case where the court found that the child should be placed with a person who falls under the mandatory disqualifiers under 671-A20, such as a person who has a conviction for murder, manslaughter, or a sexual assault. But the family court says, okay, we understand that this is a mandatory disqualifier, DHS can't be it, but we're going to dismiss DHS as the custodian, be it foster or permanent custodian, and give permanent custody or foster custody to that individual.
So as permanent custodian, are you saying that you still have the option of placing the child in a different place?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We do have that discretion. If it's our determination that placement is in the child's best interest, both by statute and by administrative rules, and 1625-10B3, Your Honor, that states that placement preferences shall be given to relatives who are able to meet licensing requirements for a provisional certificate of approval. Whereas we stated in our application and in our briefs with the ICA, DHS does not willy-nilly place with relatives. We cited to that summary disposition order in the adoption of a male child case where the child was originally placed with relatives. There were problems with the paternal grandparents in that case as drug use and inability to address those issues. So we removed them. They filed an independent adoption, which was denied. And we were in support of the family court's denial of that adoption petition. So that case illustrates that we do not disregard the safety and interests of the children, Your Honor. Our best interest also does not mean that the family court is willing, it has the authority to grant orders in the best interest of the child in disregard of the law. This is a preference. we do need guidance on how to apply this preference, be it a presumption or a rebuttable presumption.
So you're asking us to clarify what the law does say with respect to family or relative preference. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So are you asking us to rule on the whether or not your directives actually comply with the statutes?
Yes, we are, Your Honor, because there's an issue. The VGAL, or the CASA program, says it's just mere policy pronouncements. Our position, it is a legal relative placement both by federal and state law and administrative rules, as I just cited to you, Your Honor.
So you don't think that 2003 Doe adequately addressed your claim of family or relative placement preference?
It did, but part of the problems with that case, it did cite to Doe 73 Hawaii, where DHS was found to its policy back then of paying a lower rate to family resource parents was the AFDC payments, which was lower than the regular foster board payments. And this court ruled that, besides an equal protection issue, that it ran afoul with the policy in then 587-1 that stated that that the language that this court used to say that there was a relative placement preference. However, that language was deleted subsequently and the relative placement preferences were brought back in Act 199 in 2008.
Mr. Pasquale, any final thoughts? Your time has expired.
Your Honor, we ask the court basically to give us guidance. We do need guidance. We ask the court to rule that DHS does have the discretion to place and give us guidance on what is the proper standard when the family court reviews the exercise of DHS's exercise of its discretion to place. And also, there is relative placement preferences that is the law, not policy pronouncements. And thank you for coming out here in Kapolei.
Thank you very much. We'll take this matter under advisement. We thank all of our attorneys for their arguments today. And once again, thanks to the family court for its hospitality in allowing us to hold oral argument today. This court will stand in recess.
Be dry. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice.